Today in Studio 360... What's that, Miss Othmar? Yeah, I know there's a book about Charles Schulz. He was what? Depressed? Had marital problems and an existential crisis?
You blockhead!
He saw himself as a lonely and frustrated young man who wanted one thing, which was to become a cartoonist.
Biographer David Michaelis will take us inside the mind of Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts. Speaking of philosophical loners, did you read On the Road when you were in high school?
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it.
On the anniversary of Jack Kerouac's death, we're still trying to figure out his masterwork.
If you just give into it, it's going to overtake you in some way.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today we'll look at why certain women are turned off by Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And we'll hear from Orthodox Jewish reggae superstar Matis Yahu. But first, when I was a little kid reading Peanuts in the newspaper, it was the only comic strip that seemed truly modern and the only one that was more or less realistic in its depiction of the human condition. I read it religiously, along with about 350 million other people around the world. And I even still like catching bits of the Peanuts TV specials, which still make me choke up a little. It's The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, will be broadcast later this month.
If anyone had told me I'd be waiting in a pumpkin patch on Halloween night, I'd have said they were crazy.
Just think, Sally, when the Great Pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch, we'll be here to see him.
Now, that was Linus, the cute little whiz kid who carried his blanket everywhere. Linus was the writer David Michaelis' favorite character when he was a kid.
I was a Peanuts fan, as we all were. In 1967, age of 10, I remember putting on a Linus sweatshirt, a moment of great self-identification. I veered a while off to Snoopy, but came always back loyally to the kid with the weird little thoughts.
There he is! It's the Great Pumpkin! He's rising up out of the pumpkin patch!
David Michaelis has just written a new biography of Charles Schulz, who died in 2000. And he says the artist was a shy, very complicated kid growing up in small-town Minnesota.
He, on the one hand, saw himself as a lonely and alienated and somewhat frustrated young man who wanted one thing, which was to become a cartoonist. The idea of drawing was not the way you put food on the table. And also something that is called tall poppy culture, meaning that when you think too big of yourself and you reach, put your head up too high, it gets lopped off. And his father, a barber, would say frequently to him, don't get a big head. Don't think too well of yourself. And there comes Schulz drawing Charlie Brown, a character with an enormous head. And always Charlie Brown in the early days was realizing he wanted to be president or a general. He had grandiose dreams that were always handed back to him by a father who wouldn't even vote for him.
What's going on here? What are you guys talking about?
I think Charlie Brown would make a great candidate for student body president.
That sounds great, but I don't think I could win. I'd hate to run and find that nobody wanted me to be president. I don't think I could stand that.
Schulz feared in some ways that he was so bland in appearance, in manner, that if he were seen in downtown St. Paul, even by someone who knew him, they would look right through him. They wouldn't recognize him.
I have the results of my poll. You'll never be elected, Charlie Brown. You have no way of winning. No way.
My recollection of Peanuts was that I liked them, and there's a lot of this rueful comedy, sad laughs in it. The ones that actually make me laugh, inevitably, are Lucy being mean.
I would see Charlie Brown fretting over what to do with Lucy. Was he going to kick her off the baseball team? What was he going to do about her? He was sick of her. That was it. And she fires back at him, you know, if you kick me off the team, I'll never speak to you again. but I'll sure yell at you a lot. She sounds a lot like someone who's about to become an ex-wife there. And sure enough, when she was kicked off the team, that was the month that the Schultzes divorced.
So the ex-wife was the muse in all of her difficulty.
The dynamics and emotional realities of their marriage were very much the fuel that the strip was burning every week and was giving it its edge, giving it its reality.
And you have hundreds, 200 of them in the book, which is a great thing for a biography, this biography, to have.
I was very lucky to have the good grace of United Media, which charged me a nickel a strip to reproduce them on the basis that Lucy had charged a nickel for psychiatric help. And the symmetry really is quite startling.
Let's, if we can, look at some of the Peanut strips. I believe Charlie Brown went to camp regularly, did he not? And here he is on the bus going to camp, looking out the window and speaking, "Well, here I am on a bus going to camp. These camp buses are pretty nice, I guess. We've only been on this bus for 10 minutes and already I'm lonesome. I feel like I'm being drafted."
Well, Schultz here is looking back and seeing himself or remembering the feelings he had when he was sent off to war 4 days after his mother died and a day after he buried her. He was 20 years old. She had just died of a terrible cervical cancer, but he was not told that his family labored on with her illness. He could hear her cries of pain but did not know what was going on. This trauma was accentuated by World War II. Off he went. And it was on the troop train as it left St. Paul that he looked out the window and could see the house he grew up in. He could see where he and his mother had gone on the streetcar when he was a child. And he was able, I think, also to use the actual literal words of the memory in a strip just a couple of pages on where Peppermint Patty is boarding a bus for camp, and she says to Marcy, "That was very embarrassing, Marcy. Why did you have to tell Chuck that we'd miss him and that we love him?" And Marcy's saying, "It was the tenderness of the moment, sir, knowing that we were going off to camp." And then Marcy looks out the window with a really woebegone look and says, "And we may never see each other again." And then Peppermint Patty says, "Marcy!" Well, Schultz, the night before his mother died, was on his way back to camp, and his mother said to him, "Well, Sparky, I guess it's time to say goodbye." And Schultz said, "Yeah, I've got to go back to Fort Snelling." And she said, "No, it's time for us to say goodbye. We may never see each other again." And that line echoes and echoed through his life, and we see it again and again.
Well, and the fact that it wasn't a happy comic strip was what made it so singular and ultimately beloved by people, yeah?
Well, I remember both in the strip, but less so there, to tell you the truth. I remember it distinctly as an 8 to 10-year-old watching every year in the early days of the Christmas special, a Charlie Brown Christmas. And there would come a moment where Charlie Brown would say, "I'm depressed.
I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed."
"Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem."
"Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest."
That seemed to me to symbolize that melancholy one felt but had not yet articulated.
Yeah, the children on Father's Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver were never just depressed.
The boy, and I'm sorry I'm forgetting his name, but the boy who read the part, who spoke the part of Charlie Brown, recalled years later during an anniversary of the Charlie Brown Christmas that he himself felt nearly embarrassed or awkward when he had to speak these lines because he knew how sophisticated they were. He knew that they were the words of adults. There was something scary. There was something taboo about them. It was, I guess, probably for the way my children watch Family Guy these days and get a kind of edgy adult world coming out of a childish show.
And he was also a believing Christian, yeah?
He was. He came back from World War II and, like so many veterans, joined a church. And his church was the Church of God. He was baptized in Lake Fallon in Minnesota in the summer of 48 and became an extremely devoted believer. And yet though he did not like to stand on a street corner and expound beliefs, he nevertheless did some at certain points with his youth group actually become a street corner preacher.
Well, and beyond that, in the first Charlie Brown Christmas, the first big primetime special, he puts biblical text into this show, which caused a bit of a ruckus.
Well, and we all remember the moment of Linus stepping out. I mean, to this day, it's one of those moments that brings the hairs up on the back of your neck.
"Lights, please." And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And they were sore afraid, and the angel said unto them, Fear not.
In fact, it was very soon, it was the next day. People were clamoring with praise for Schultz and saying, thanks for putting Christ back in Christmas.
That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
But Schultz himself, I think, really believed up to a point, and then you start hearing him in the 70s declaring himself a secular humanist. The strip, I think, really backs up the picture of Charles Schultz as a boy, as an artist, evolving through his life. On his honeymoon, he, by the account of his bride and later ex-wife Joyce Halverson, he turned to her on their honeymoon as they drove west to Colorado Springs and said, you know, I don't think I'll ever be happy. What a thing to hear on your honeymoon. I think he saw unhappiness as a way of life in some ways, yearning, longing, never fulfilling.
But punctuated by moments of kind of romantic ecstasy and swooning.
Yes, but where I saw Schultz so clearly in the strip was in Snoopy sitting on the doghouse roof with the typewriter and typing out the famous sentence, the Bulwer Lytton.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Yes, and there you see Linus coming by and saying, oh, that's a nice sentence. Good luck on your second sentence. And then you become aware that Snoopy's actually stuck at the first sentence. Well, as the first tortured paragraph emerges of this novel that Snoopy is presumably writing, we see that actually he really wants to just go back to the beginning. And where his happiness is writing out the portent and drama of it was a dark and stormy night. And I think Schultz, in so much of his life, he loved to be at the beginning. He loved the first flush of romance. He loved the idea of love. He wanted to be at the beginning, and in fact, cartoonists are rendered beginners every morning. Peanuts was one of the cartoons that was always unresolved and which has no real ending and can therefore go on and on forever.
David Michaelis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
David Michaelis' book is called Schultz and Peanuts, a biography. And the jacket, by the way, consists of Charlie Brown's yellow shirt with a trademark black zigzag across the front. Coming up, a newly married couple hits their first speed bump. She doesn't like his favorite book.
I think it's uncool that he's lusting after girls who are like 16 and younger. And I think it's uncool that Dean Moriarty, the character who's supposed to be the coolest, marries three women and kind of rotates between all of them. That's your hero?
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
The solitude of the actual oneness of the unbornness of the unborn essence of everything. Comma? Nay, the true pure foreverhood. That big blank potential that can ray forth anything it wants from its pure store. That blazing bliss.
We're listening to Jack Kerouac, age 37, reading from his article called Is There a Beat Generation in 1959.
Why should I attack what I love out of life? This is beat. Live your lives out? Nah. Love your lives out.
Was Kerouac chemically altered at the time? Maybe. Or maybe he was just high on success.
But that wild eager picture of me on the cover of the book On the Road, where I look so beat.
2 years earlier, 1957, his novel On the Road had been published, and it was that rare thing, a cutting-edge work of art that was also an instant bestseller. We asked two of our contributors, Hilary Frank and Jonathan Menjivar, a newly married couple, why the book still speaks to readers. But it turned out that Hilary had never read it. So Jonathan gave her his beloved copy with all his underlinings and scribbles from when he was 17.
So far, I'm not entertained.
What do you mean?
I'm on what? Page 109. And I just feel like nothing's happened, and he's heading on his way back to the East Coast because he's like failed at I don't even know what. I don't know what he was setting out to do.
But I think like the thing of it is that what happens doesn't really matter. It's more about this feeling, like if you just give into it, it's going to overtake you in some way.
That was 3 weeks ago. I could see what Hillary was saying, but picking up the book now, I still fall for the way Kerouac puts words together. I thought my friend Davy Rothbart might be better at articulating what makes me like the book so much. Davy pretty much lives his life as if he's a character and on the road, touring the country every year, promoting this magazine he makes called Found. He stays on people's floors, in their basements, the side of the road.
When you wake up in like a little gully and there's kind of frost on the weeds around you and you just feel like rugged and, I don't know, you feel cool. I mean, and that's what part of On the Road is about, and that's what part of some of the reason people seized on it. But I just don't think it's only a mythic allure. I think, like, it's real.
That right there, that gets to the heart of why I think On the Road, even with its flaws, is something special. There's an energy and a romance that I know Hill should get. Davy fell for the book in the same way I did when he was a kid. In a lot of ways, he felt like he was Sal Paradise, the character who's kind of Kerouac's proxy in the book. Sal was a writer.
He also is falling in love with girls, like, every city they go to.
Right.
And that really matched my experience. I think, for me, that was actually one of the most powerful things about the book, Sal's longing for girls. And the way that mm-hmm. he can spot somebody in some roller rink or in some bar or just walking down the street and just feel so overwhelmingly in love that it just makes his heart, you know, miserable.
I think that's one thing that a lot of women, and certainly Hillary, respond really negatively to. Sure, he's falling in love with all these women, but then he's leaving them all behind. Do you think you have to be a boy to really understand that?
I don't know. Like, yeah, maybe it is this sort of romantic thing that's not that cool if you're the girl that's left behind.
The thing is, it's not so much that I think it's uncool of him to be leaving girls behind. I think it's uncool that he's lusting after girls who are, like, 16 and younger. And I think it's uncool that Dean Moriarty, the character who's supposed to be the coolest, marries three women and kind of rotates between all of them. And he's actively looking for more women to sleep with on the side. That's your hero?
I mean, isn't everyone you look at that's cool? You're overlooking some major flaw?
That's my friend Molly Eigen. Back in high school, she was obsessed with On the Road. She even went on a road trip where she packed herself bologna sandwiches, just like Sal Paradise does. I guess I wonder, like, why overlook their attitudes towards women? Did that stuff not bother you?
I remember being bothered by it, but I do remember thinking, like, I would be the woman that was, like, in with them. Like, I would be the one woman that they would be like, oh, I'll take her seriously, and she's not like the other women, and unlikely.
I think I figured out what the problem is. Jonathan?
Uh-huh?
I think I'm too old for On the Road.
What makes you say that?
Molly read it in high school. So did you. So did Davy. I think maybe it's just a teen thing. Here, let's do this. Let's go to a high school English class that's reading On the Road and see what actual teenagers think of it.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Hillary, that's not a real person. That's a TV show. It's Kim Kelly from Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, but Kim Kelly is exactly the kind of kid who should love On the Road. She drinks, she has sex, she doesn't give a damn. Let's talk to Rebecca Kirshner. She wrote Kim Kelly's lines in that scene.
It felt refreshing and cool for Kim Kelly to say that the book stunk because it's like you're so afraid to criticize great works of art that it's like, oh yeah, that emperor is not wearing clothes.
I figured Rebecca would be all rebellious like Kim Kelly and she'd commiserate with me.
She didn't?
Well, she's not in love with the book now, but she did like it in high school, so she gets why a lot of teens are into it. She still sees something in it, too.
I don't know. It's sort of cute how... Okay, this is what it is. Like, how much of a rebel are you if you have time to sit down and type something up? I mean, you're not out getting drunk or having a knife fight and, you know, whether you're Hemingway or you're Kerouac or something. It's like, well, yeah, but you're kind of nerds because you're you're writers, really, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
At that age, also, you're sort of testing different identities, and, like, every book is a way of being a different person.
Right. Hillary, I think I just want you to see what the high school me would have been moved by.
It's hard when somebody you really care about just doesn't get or like something that is really important to you.
That's my friend Davy Rothbard again.
You know, I know Hillary. She's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like anybody who has a curiosity about the people we share the world with is someone that would like this book.
I think that's a terrible attitude. It's a poor understanding of the book to just think it's a barometer of coolness.
John Leland wrote a book called Why Kerouac Matters. I figured he could help answer my biggest question about On the Road, why people like it so much when it just doesn't feel well written. One of the first things you learn in a creative writing class is show, don't tell. And to me, this book is all telling. I never feel like I'm put in the moment.
Yes, we have made an icon of a book that's unevenly written. But the descriptive scene of the brothel in Mexico, which becomes increasingly more hallucinatory as they go along,
mm-hmm.
I think is a really vivid scene.
And that's also one of the scenes that kind of turned my stomach, because that's the one where, you know, he's lusting after this 15-year-old girl.
But poor Sal, he's a step slow all the time, and there he is. He's in this brothel, and he still can't approach the girl that he's really interested in.
Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, I don't want to see him get the girl that he wants in that situation because she's so young.
And so he doesn't.
Right.
So, you know, you can go away happy that her virtue, such as it is, remains uncompromised, at least by Sal Paradise.
Touché.
But also, don't think of it just as Dean's book. I mean, it's easy to read the book as this celebration of men behaving badly. But Sal keeps himself at a distance from Dean's behavior and really is able to put it behind him. Think of it as Sal's book in addition to Dean's book.
And what will I get out of that?
You'll get a book about the things that male friends go through. You know, they go through this sexual admiration. There's really a great love affair. They burn pretty hot, and then they get mad at one another, and they fall out, which I think men are never able to show in real life or in their depictions of their friendships.
Yeah, you know what's happening is that I'm starting to like the book more just from talking to you about it. You know, I think your interpretation of it is making me feel more fond of it.
Oh, good. Well, I'm not really trying to sell the book. That's not that's not my job.
I'm not trying to sell the book to you either. It's not like I'm going to love you any less if you don't like it. I just want you to see that there are moments that are great.
Well, there's this one part that I marked. It's near the end, you know, when they're in Mexico, and Sal's trying to sleep in the car, and it's just way too hot in there. So he gets out of the car, and he gets on the roof, because he just wants to feel the cool metal on his skin. And he lies there on his back, and there's still no breeze, and the mosquitoes are eating him alive.
And what do you think of that?
Well, I guess it's this one moment where I can really feel what's going on with him. All he can do to get through that night is give in to the heat and the mosquitoes and kind of let his blood and the bugs become one. Right there, he really does what I want a writer to do.
Is it okay that it makes me happy to hear you say that?
Yeah, of course.
Hillary Frank and Jonathan Menjivar live in Philadelphia. As you may know, the original manuscript of On the Road is a scroll, 120 feet long and 9 inches wide. It is on display this fall at Columbia College in Chicago. The year that Kerouac's book was published happened to be the same year that my family began its annual summer ritual of the long driving vacation across the country. To the Dakotas that first year, to Montana, to Canada, to the Deep South, to New England. Great big station wagon, no seat belts, a silver trailer coming behind, two-lane blacktops and brand new interstate highways.
Another American family caught up in that same annual ritual around the same time was the Friedlanders. And Lee Friedlander, a photographer, used those trips to make a lot of the black and white images that established him as one of the most acute, celebrated modern chroniclers of America. Young Eric, the Friedlander's son, grew up to become an innovative cellist. And his latest album is inspired by those Friedlander family trips. All the music on it performed on a solo cello. It's called Block Ice and Propane.
When I started writing the music, it had this Americana and this roots feel to it. And what I often do is just sit with the cello and kind of improvise and try to develop. Like, if I have a good start, I want to figure out the rest of the song. And these memories started filtering back, these memories of these trips that I took with my family every summer, my whole life, practically. And the block ice was an obligation that you had to fulfill because we had to get the big block of ice because otherwise the food would go stale. Actually, the original title was Block Ice, Tongue, and Propane. My father, there was a stretch when he began preparing tongue in the pressure cooker for lunch almost all the time. And
Block Ice and Propane is the name of one of the songs. And since you are holding a cello, why don't you play it?
Okay, cool.
Nice indeed. That was Eric Friedlander playing his song Block Ice and Propane off the album of the same name. Now, there's a bow sitting next to you, which you didn't use at all. That was entirely plucked. How common, or rather how uncommon, is it to have works for cello that are not bowed at all?
I think it's fairly uncommon. I think me, along with most people, consider the bow the primary voice of the cello, but I really wanted to turn it around because My first instrument was guitar before I picked up the cello, and I played a lot of folk guitar and blues and things like that. And so I developed a finger-picking style. And in the last 3-4 years, I've been trying to get better at carrying those techniques to the cello and see what might happen. I don't know. There's some really beautiful quality that you get from plucking the cello. It's kind of guitar-ish, but it's much warmer and darker.
You talk in the liner notes beautifully about this sort of magical memories of driving at night in particular.
Yeah, well, you know, we did something then, which I'm sure is completely illegal now, that you just can't do, is what my sister and I would ride. We had a camper shell that sat on top of a 66 Chevrolet pickup, and, you know, we sat above the cab looking out the big picture window of the camper. You know, and at the end of these trips, we would get to kind of like Ohio or somewhere like that, and it was just, let's hit the turnpikes and get home. And that meant driving late into the night and pulling over at truck stops and sleeping for an hour. And we would just sit up there kind of dozing and listening to the radio or playing games, but also turn out the lights and just look out that window. And this is the magic of night driving. I still have a feeling for that now.
And the song on this record, Night White, is inspired by that set of memories.
Yeah.
Record, there is a fairly radical bipolarity, if not variety, between these sort of beautiful American rootsy songs like the one you just played and a song called Yakima, and then there's these dissonant modern pieces as well, seemingly from, I mean, they could be from two different records. What appeals to you about doing both things?
I wanted to carry a technique I started with my first record, which was to improvise live in the studio and bring that kind of on-the-spot feeling to the record. So I did that, and I really like the way the contrasts work because it gives you a kind of darker place to go, and where from when you exit that area and back into the kind of sweetness of the plucked pieces, you feel kind of refreshed and ready to hear one of those again.
Well, we're going to take you up on that. And we warned you that we were going to ask you to improvise something, but you don't know what I'm going to ask you to improvise off of.
That's true.
It is from Jack Kerouac's On the Road, early on in the book, and I will read it. A guy with a kind of tool shack on wheels, a truck full of tools that he drove standing up like a modern milkman, gave me a ride up the long hill, where I immediately got a ride from a farmer and his son heading out for Adel in Iowa. In this town, under a big elm tree near a gas station, I made the acquaintance of another hitchhiker, a typical New Yorker, an Irishman who'd been driving a truck for the post office most of his work years and was now headed for a girl in Denver and a new life. I think he was running away from something in New York, the law, most likely. He was a real red-nosed young drunk of 30 and would have bored me ordinarily, except that my senses were sharp for any kind of human friendship. He wore a beat sweater and baggy pants and had nothing with him in the way of a bag, just a toothbrush and handkerchiefs. He said we ought to hitch together. I should have said no, because he looked pretty awful on the road. But we stuck together and got a ride with a taciturn man to Stewart, Iowa, a town in which we were really stranded.
Thank you. Very cool. Thank you very much. That was Eric Friedlander improvising a song that you, he, and I heard for the very first time, inspired by Jack Kerouac's, or a passage of Jack Kerouac's, On the Road. Why did you decide to pick up the bow rather than pluck for that piece?
You know, when you mentioned Kerouac, I thought it was going to be a little more brash, the period, and a little more, the passage, a little more aggressively with that kind of dark humor, and it really was kind of a sweet passage, and had a lot of warmth to it, and it really captured that kind of mile after mile feeling you can get when you're driving in the United States. So that's kind of, in the end, what I was after.
Well done. Eric Friedlander, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you.
Eric Friedlander's latest record is called Block Ice and Propane. You can hear another exclusive live performance by Eric at studio360.org. Coming up, if highway signs look fuzzy, don't fidget with your glasses. Get a new sign.
Opening it up, widening the typeface, there are minuscule changes, but they could be seen at 900 feet.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Early road signs were not uniform. They were hand-painted mostly on wood and all in capital letters because lowercase was hard to render with a paintbrush. As federal highways became standardized, so did the signs, but with very little thought given to the design. And now, as drivers get older and their headlights brighter, the original typeface looks increasingly fuzzy. That's where graphic designer Don Meeker comes in. In this week's Design for the Real World, he explains how he helped bring highway signs back into focus.
In President Eisenhower's term, they said, we need standard highway signs nationwide because we have these new freeways. So we can take a missile from Altoona, PA to Albuquerque really very fast. It's kind of funny to hear. The reason for that highway system was to mobilize the country in the Cold War.
What's wrong with this picture? The common, everyday spectacle of modern traffic on roads that are as out of date as the covered wagon.
For the freeway signs, there was a new development. A mixed case typeface. It was developed by a man named Ted Forbes from Leroy Lettering. Well, Leroy Lettering, an engineer or an architect will remember, was used to label drawings. So he made these letters, blew them up photographically, and created a typeface. That's all he knew. That's what was available to him in 1949. And from that came Highway Gothic Series E Modified. The astonishing thing is that that has lived for 58 years.
I've been traveling this road a long, long time. I'm starting to get the blues.
The roadscape, however, has become much, much more complex. The two-lane freeway is now a four-lane freeway. Urban driving, the old rural route out of town, now is filled with all sorts of commercial clutter.
Road signs and middle lines are hypnotizing me.
So I think the competition for your eye has become greater, yet the side of the road where you place signs has not become wider.
Road signs and middle lines will be the death of me.
There's no reason why we have to be living if computers were regulated like highway signs, we'd still be living with vacuum tubes. Intel would be making vacuum tubes. They wouldn't be making microchips. And so in the late 80s, the federal government became aware that the driving population was getting older. They were also aware of these new high-brightness materials and the halation effect. Well, halation is when your headlights shine into the material, it reflects back to you. So if that is not properly balanced for your eye, the white will be so much more intense that it will overshadow the letter form or become much too bright.
and the sign can be a big glare, which they can't discern what they're reading. So the flaw of the standard E-modified, the upper-lowercase typeface that you see on freeway signs, is that it has a consistent stroke width. It's like strapping two pencils together and pulling them around in a full circle. That makes the interior shapes or the counters of the typeface very small. It is quite squat, short, and quite heavy. There were a number of studies done, and the final results were just make everything 20% larger. Well, a 20% larger cap high increases the size of the sign by 50%. Were it possible, the cost would be in the billions.
What's a citizen gonna do?
And so we looked at the typefaces and realized finally that we were going to have to start from scratch.
Our American dream of Futurama on wheels can come true.
This is something we'd never done before.
Our highway engineers know the way. It's ours for the asking.
And we drew the initial version of Clearview. We opened up the terminals. That is, unlike a Helvetica, where the E curls around on itself and completes the circle, the letter terminates with a straight, nearly straight stroke. So you don't create a trap for light because your eye closes a word up at great distances. And it worked. Different typefaces have different voices. They can be delicate, they can shout, and in this case with Clearview, the voice of it is as the invisible umpire. It has to make a good call. This 20% gain in legibility for the same size sign has saved many lives.
I can see clearly now, rain has gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. There's gonna be a bright, bright sunshine day.
Don Meeker is a graphic designer. You can see some examples of the highway typefaces he talked about at studio360.org.
I think I can make it now, all the pain has gone.
Derek John produced our story.
All of the bad feelings have disappeared. Here's the rainbow I've been praying for. It's gonna be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. Look all around, there's nothing but blue sky. Look straight ahead, nothing but blue.
A sign can be simply utilitarian, or it can be a metaphor, especially for people who discover religion later in life.
Wisdom rains like water from the heavens to below. Crush my earth, seeds grow, garden starts to grow. You know you gotta rise, although you like to flow. You can't keep staring out the window. Earth, water, wind, fire, we stay low while getting higher. Spark and light, the fighting tires stay wired and light and loads fly alive. Weep, well, chain, cry, let out a sigh. Energize, give my last time, life shouldn't pass me by. Rise to the occasion.
A singer named Matas Yahoo stormed the record charts in 2005 with his album Youth. He's an Hasidic Jew, and his shows are packed with hipsters, hippies, and Orthodox Jewish men. We ask Matas Yahoo how he got on this roundabout path from being a suburban high school dropout to a devout Jewish reggae superstar.
You know, I went to my first day of high school when I was 17 and just decided this is garbage and I'm not going to subdue myself to something that I don't believe in. And I just took off the only way that I knew how to, which was this counterculture I had been exposed to. And I went in a VW bus with a friend of mine to Burlington, Vermont, and was living in the park for a while. And when I was there, there was a kid I saw one time in the park. He had a hand drum and he was singing, and he had like the most powerful and the sweetest voice, and he was singing the Rastaman chant.
Say one bright morning.
one bright morning when my work is over, I'm going to fly away home to Zion. And, like, the words just rang true. And, like, the way he was belting it, just, it just made a real impression on me. And then from wherever I went, I had a drum with me. And wherever I traveled to, I would always sing that song. You know, I'd sing it by myself. If I woke up in some living room somewhere, I would, in the morning, I would sit there and I would sing that song. That became kind of like my theme song. It meant redemption. If I had the wings of a dove, if I had the wings of a dove, I'd fly away home to Zion, fly away home. We're gonna fly away home. Later on, when I became religious, I was learning something in a book called the Tanya, which is like a fundamental text of Hasidism, and it brings a line from the Psalms of King David. And the line says, if I had the wings like a dove, I would fly away home to Zion. Because when I heard this song, I never understood, well, this is why the lyrics ring so true to me. This is why the concept made sense to me. Zion, I had this image of Zion. I went to Jerusalem when I was 16 and sat and saw the sun setting over Jerusalem, and I had a very powerful experience. So I always thought, as I was kind of going through high school and going through, you know, the suburbs that I lived in, one morning, I'll be back in Jerusalem.
I've been here too long. I said, Lord, won't you raise me up from the ground? Senor, see, I've been gone for so long.
To not be involved in singing and music and reggae would mean sort of like eliminating a piece of myself. That's the generation that we live in. That's what separates us from any other past generation in Russia or in Spain or wherever, is that we live in America, and most of us were not raised religious, and so we've been influenced by other cultures that are a part of us. When I sing it, I feel it's like sort of like a memory from almost a past life. You know, what is it, like 10 years later? And it's hard to still have that same sensitivity and intensity, because at that time, that was all I had. That was it. I wasn't making a living playing music. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have a life. I didn't have a religion that gave me three times a day to spend, you know, hours praying. And so now I have a whole lifestyle that's about trying to connect to God. So when I sing that song, it's not as potent as when I was like this homeless teenager in the park.
Did I hear the words of the Hayamon say, throne going down, 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 Babylonian throne going down.
Matis Yahu, formerly Matthew Miller, is on tour now promoting his new record, Shattered. Michael May produced our story. If some song or book or movie changed your life once upon a time, we would like to hear about it. You can get in touch with us at studio360.org. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Lital Molad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Catherine Epstein,
Greta Cohn,
Emily Frost,
Chloe Plant,
Hamad Ahmed.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
There's something about the presidency that just makes you do things that none of us can predict.
Writer Sarah Vowell on the known unknowns of electing a new president.
Welcome to the crapshoot, folks.
Buckle down with Nixon, buckle down. We can win with Nixon.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.